The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Tom Sisti. Tom is Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP, and Tom is a longtime veteran of the procurement world, having worked in both government and industry for a number of years, going back into the 90s, and that's some stuff where I guess we'll talk a little bit about Tom. Tom is the chief historian of the procurement process, I would say. Right, Tom?
Every time we do this, you come up with something like that. Stop.
Okay. Well, I have to. It's supposed to be fun. Yeah, it's supposed to be fun.
I'm really enjoying myself.
Good. I'm glad you are, Tom. So I guess, you know, I wanted to bring you on the show and just talk about, you know, to start out by acquisition reform. I'd put that in quotes. Mm-hmm. You know, just right now there's a lot of noise about acquisition reform, and there's been proposed legislation on the Hill. I think the House Armed Services Committee, if I'm not mistaken, is doing a review sort of the procurement system and looking at getting suggestions and ideas from across the board stakeholders in an effort to try to figure out what they may decide to initiate in terms of legislation, I guess. I mean, you know, you had, you know, the Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act. That's still, I guess, potentially something that could be passed. You have the administration talking about innovation and, you know, federal strategic sourcing, which to me are contradictory. But so there's a lot going on there. So I thought I would you know, give you an opportunity to talk about that and what else is going on. So let's just talk about your experience and what it sort of, before we get into the issues themselves, you know, what does it take to actually get something accomplished in terms of changing either statute or regulation, policy, that sort of thing?
Well, first, I wouldn't call it noise. I think it's more substantial than just noise around the edge. I think you have people who are very well-intentioned, who are very, very concerned about this system and what's happening, especially as we have introduced more complexity into the day-to-day lives of the government organizations, and also as the government organizations are facing tremendous budget challenges. One thing I think that you could say is different between now and back in, say, the late 80s, early 90s, is this whole idea of budget pressure and these external pressures that we're dealing with. I mean, the stuff you read every day in the paper, from the Ebola issue to the ISIL issue. You have a lot of
cybersecurity.
Of course. You have a lot of external pressures that weren't front and center back then. I think also back then there was, in a similar way, concern about the way the government was buying its goods and services. Certainly from the standpoint of technology, there was concern that the government was not keeping up with the innovation cycle of the private sector. And so there was an evolving consensus that a change needed to be made. That was a bipartisan consensus. It was not only bipartisan, but multi-committee, if you will, on Capitol Hill. With the Armed Services Committee, it started in the Senate. We had a provision, the Section 800 provision, remember, that brought together experts across sections.
800 panel, right.
Yep. Right. Well, that was funded, and it was staffed, resourced to address a defined set of law on acquisition. I think today we're going much broader, dealing with issues surrounding innovation, technology, and again, these ancillary issues, cyber, what have you, that influence the buying decision. But we're doing it in an environment that is much more resource constrained. I think that...
And to your point, it's an environment where the rapidity or the rapidness, the repetitiveness, no, I mean, the pace of change, the momentum for change, things change daily with technology, mm-hmm. with the challenges, whether in cyber, those kind of things. So there's, you know, the environment we live in is different than it was then in terms of those external. I think that's a great point.
Well, the technology evolution cycle certainly is rapid, and we're facing technologies we never had before. But again, this is an environment where these technologies also bring a tremendous amount of complexity to an organization. So the idea is that how do we leverage different processes, different technologies to reduce the level of complexity in the day-to-day decision-making of our government employees. It's a hard job. It's a very hard job, and it's something that requires stakeholder involvement. It's not something that can be driven from the top down necessarily. It's almost got to be driven up, cascaded upward, if you will, from the users, so that they understand. I think we understand as a government community the challenges that are faced in managing programs.
Right. Okay. Well, what are those challenges? I think you mentioned some things about the 90s, the pace of technology in the 80s, where commercial technology was outpacing the government's technology in terms of, especially at DOD and weapon systems and what the commercial technological evolution, and a lot of the reform was how do we be able to leverage that technological advantage and get access to it from a commercial perspective. I think we hear the same things today. In terms of where we are, or growing concern that there's beginning to be a gap again, or there is a gap, that's one issue. But just what do you see are some of the biggest challenges? You mentioned complexity of the system. Just run down some of what you see as some of the key challenges.
Yeah, you're right. I think the more things change, the more they stay the same. In some instances, we are becoming process laden. We're oversight heavy. We probably have a lot of duplication of oversight, which in a strained resource environment, it puts a lot of pressure on people to perform, because you have the same cluster of people who are managing a program also subject to that oversight. You may have duplication of contracting activities. That's been one of the issues raised. So some of that was there back then. But remember, the motivator was that we had the end of the Cold War back in the 90s. So the government couldn't continue to buy things the way it was buying before. I think we have a different kind of imperative that's addressing the same kind of result, which is the government can't continue to operate in a process-laden system and still meet the needs of technology or technological needs as they evolve over time.
Right. Well, and just in terms of complexity, or it seems to me the system has gotten significantly more complex over the last 10 to 15 years. There was, we've been alluding to or talking about the reform of the 90s, and the idea, it seems to me, from what I recall of it, was, we want the Cold War dividend, we want to streamline processes, we're going to cut federal employees, cut the acquisition workforce, but we'll streamline the process so we'll be able to accomplish the same amount with less people because it's streamlined. We'll make it easier to access commercial technologies. That will save us money and save us resources in the long run too.
You're forgetting also, between then and now, we had a war in the middle of it, which at a time where we were decreasing resources, we were massively increasing the contract actions that had to take place.
Right, operational tempo. Well, what happened, was we cut all those folks and we streamlined the process, put that in quotes. Then all of a sudden you did have, to your point, we had the war, and then the amount of spend, literally doubled, from about $200 billion, $250 billion to over $500 billion during the last decade, and the strain on the system. And rather than investing in the system and the folks in the system, the idea was to layer on more, increase the process, try to protect the government fisc by having more oversight, rather than more contracting officers. That seems to be is that fair?
I think you have probably less reliance on discretion and That could be for a number of reasons. I think the volatility of the system when something goes wrong, people are called out for it, and that becomes problematic. I don't think we discern that well between well-intentioned actions and actions that are not well-intentioned. And I think sometimes we lump even mistakes into the latter bucket, and that tends to make people gun-shy from the standpoint of exercising discretion. But, you know, you were engaged on the transactional side back then, and I'd be interested sure. in seeing what was the environment like for you as a person who was using the system.
Right. Well, we can talk about it when we come back.
Okay.
Okay, Tom. All right, now we do have to take a break. My guest today is Tom Sisti. He's the Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP. And when we come back, I'll try to answer Tom's question. What was it like on the operational level? And we can continue our discussion of the challenges facing the system and might focus a little bit on the budget and what that means, sequestration for operations and for agencies, as well as then turn to what Tom recommends to fix the system. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Sisti. Tom is the Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP. And Tom, when you took a break, you asked me this question about operational tempo and what it was like to be in the system. And, I did do a lot of contracting work, advising contracting officers when I worked for the government, especially in the, throughout the 90s. And it was an interesting time because before acquisition reform, I worked a lot in the IT arena. And you had the GSBCA, the General Services Board of Contract Appeals, which had bid protest authority. And things were very process-driven. I mean, the goal was to do a procurement, and I worked on big IT procurements worth, literally hundreds of millions of dollars often. The goal was, let's make sure we can survive a protest. We've got a document. We've got to create a process that we know is defendable, and then use that each and every time. And it almost became, the result was, success was measured on whether or not you either got a protest, and then if you did get a protest, whether you successfully defended the government's decision to award to Company X. Did the government get best value? I don't know. It took so long, often, that technology was, as soon as the award was made, if you got through the protest window, the technology upon which the award was based was already obsolete, and you spent the next, several months doing modifications to add the new technology to replace it. And I also think it was, in a certain sense, a less competitive market for a number of reasons. There weren't as many companies, IT companies or service, and there was less services being purchased. But I also think that the contract structures where you had typically for IT award to one company for an indefinite quantity, indefinite delivery contract that had a relatively small guaranteed minimum to the rest of the estimated quantities, and then that company got the contract for 8 years, 10 years. So literally, you had this company, locked into a particular agency for 8 to 10 years, and you didn't have competition for future requirements in year 7. That, I mean, theoretically, at that point, there were a number of companies could have met or not, and it would be interoperable. That was sort of what I experienced a lot during the early 90s. And then when reform took place, and there was a lot of streamlining, the growth of GSA schedules, there was it was actually a pretty exciting time. I know internally it was like we were trying to figure out ways to streamline a process, to take time out of it, to get directly to the point of people, being able to do business. And you saw the tempo of things pick up, and people weren't locked into a particular company. I mean, there was a lot of dynamic stuff going on, and then you also had the creation of the IT GWACs. At the same time, that ultimately the ones we see today, Alliant or NASA SOUP, which is the oldest one, and NIH, the OSP-3, these multiple award contracts create this competitive environment. So as a whole, and I think those are all good positive developments. So I saw both sides of it. And it seems to me now one of the concerns is that there might be too many contracts duplicating things, It's gotten back to all about the process and whether you comply with the process. Not necessarily because you can get a big protest, although those have increased, but because you have an oversight community has come in and they're going to take a look at everything you've done and, you know, use and measure you based on whether if you followed the process, you could have saved X when, you know. Anyway, yeah, that's
speculative, but right. But I don't think I thought the protests went down last year, but.
What, yeah, what, you know, over the last 5 years, let's say, they've gone. I mean,
yeah, but
okay.
Remember, the legislation was passed to allow task order protests. Go back.
That's true.
Multiple war task and delivery order contracts were not protestable unless there was a CECA violation after the enactment of FASA and after enactment of Clinger-Cohen. But I think what happened was you started seeing these ballooning task orders, and people said, look, if it looks like a straight-up contract award and it acts like one, we should allow protests there.
Well, I was on the SARA panel, who voted, and I voted for the recommendation.
Thank you very much for that, Roger.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, don't get me wrong. There's, a GAO bid protest versus one of those old GSBCA protests. They're two completely different things.
That's true.
In terms of the amount of work and the stress that are on folks.
But, what you said, there is a crossover point. You are spending public funds. You have to have oversight. You
sure.
have to have some kind of process where people who feel like they have not been treated fairly in the award process should have some voice and some mechanism to be heard. You have to identify, and this is the tricky part, and it's hard, and that's why we're constantly revisiting it, almost as if it's a gravitational force pulling us back. It's hard to identify where the crossover is between process focus and performance focus. And I think we're confronting that again. I also was interested in your comment about just the nature of contracting itself. It seemed like the world was simpler then. You didn't have MAX, you didn't have GWAC, you didn't have multiple. We have so many different vehicle types and so many different contracting activities now, so that it's the pie, if you will, of actions is bigger. And that means more to monitor and potentially more to not have go as well as you would like. It's interesting your comment about this idea of being locked into a vendor, because I think you see people are complaining about that again, but for different reasons, I think. I think back then it was you had this large multi-year award.
Sure.
And today I think it's the complexity of the systems. When you buy these massively complex systems that take several years to implement, once you have them implemented, you don't want to just turn around and flash cut out of them. You're spending a lot of money, a lot of time to get them up and running. And you'll see, I think some of the proposals on the Hill have acknowledged this. Certainly the New Democrat Coalition National Security Task Force came out with a paper recently that identified this notion. They called it vendor lock-in. I'm not sure. I think that's a term of art in economics, and it may not be exactly. The concept is there, though. The idea that you want to have the capacity over the life of these large programs to evolve. So how do you do that? And perhaps the best way to do that is, I'm not going with open source, but talking about open standards.
Sure.
So that vendors can participate in the evolution of a program. I mean, that has to be studied. You have to look at what the impact on initial bidding would be if you put that kind of a process in place, because, you have people submitting in competition for a given program. Will they submit the same value, the same deal proposition, knowing that they could be swapped out at stage X, Y, or Z down the road? I don't think that's been studied yet. But there's a lot of creativity out there, both on both sides of the aisle and both houses of Congress, where people, I think we are, if there's one thing that's similar to back then, we are approaching a point where people are really coming to the same mind that we've got to do something to fix the system.
Right. So I guess, so I was talking, I put on my lawyer's hat, right? And said, mm-hmm. The contract structures at the time, maybe by necessity, sort of limited and created, quote, vendor lock-in. And so what you're saying is it's the complexity of both the problem and the solution lends itself to an agency or a customer being not, I wouldn't say stuck, being that they have the company or the organization that crafted the solution, that designed and delivered the solution, and it takes a lot of time. It's very complex. It's high risk to go someplace else after that. Or what
I guess
are you
I have trouble using the term lock-in, because right. lock-in implies that there is some kind of market constraint. And you really can't say there is when the vendor is there based on a full and open competition where people had the right to propose solutions and they were evaluated against a fair and publicized set of criteria and then they won. So it's not exactly lock-in sure. per se, but it doesn't necessarily, I don't think the whole problem is necessarily associated with the technologies, but a good part of it is.
Okay. And we do have, Tom, we already have to take our next break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to Tom Sisti. He's a chief legislative counsel for SAP. And I think on this issue, it's kind of interesting. We can tease some more stuff out about commercial item contracting, open standards, barriers to entry in the federal marketplace, and what do we do about that? You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest today is Tom Sisti. He's chief legislative counsel for SAP. And hey, Tom, you know, being the guest of the show is really hard sometimes, and I screw up. So, but not really a screw up. But, I mentioned when we were going to break that we were going to talk about commercial item acquisition and that sort of, and barriers to entry and, and how do we promote innovation, whatever that is. And maybe we talk about that as well. What is innovation? This segment, but first, we didn't get a chance to talk about the budget and sequestration and, where we've been and sort of where do you think we're going and more fundamentally, what does the budget uncertainty mean for government and industry?
Well, there are two ways to look at this. I think first you have to look at the fact that we're in recess until after the election, and then Congress is slated to come back sort of the early part of November. And the only thing that I think we can say with certainty is that we'll be dealing with some kind of action on funding the government. We're funded into December. And the question is, will we be dealing with a continuing resolution or will we be dealing with an omnibus? And the second question is, whatever we're dealing with, will it be short-term or long-term? And that just remains to be seen. I think people listening to this show probably know the difference between the two. A continuing resolution would hold us to current fiscal year spending levels, whereas an omnibus would be a vehicle for new starts. So there's that uncertainty. And I think that word is the key word in all of these discussions. Sequestration is not what one would call a surgical process. Where you're doing this kind of thoughtful, reflective analysis of the budget, given agency.
Setting priorities, right?
Exactly. Right. You don't have really an environment where you're motivating excellence in assessing your process, assessing your organization, and then implementing a management plan. To implement really a rational and responsible approach, you have to have some level of certainty. If you didn't know what your paycheck was going to be, or if you were sitting there going, "Okay, I might not have a cut next year," it'd be hard to plan out more than the very basics of what you're trying to do on a personal level. So I think, again, it's no secret that there's a lot of concern around the sequestration levels, especially in light of existing and future threats that we're going to face. So that's about all you can say about the budget. There's not a lot.
Right. So, fundamentally, people can't plan for the long term and make the decisions and set priorities. It starts to impact your ability to effectively respond to the state of play on the ground today, right?
Well, it's a double whammy. You can't plan and you can't address the normal cycle of expenses that you're going to deal with based on certain policy actions. You know, if you stop engaging in conflict, you still have reset of personnel and systems and weapons, et cetera. That, how's that going to be affected in the process? So it's not an easy way to manage, and not necessarily the most efficient way to manage. Now, how we get around this, I mean, I think we'll probably have a little more clarity after we understand the outcome in November.
Right. That one. And I'll have it back on the show, and we can talk about it then. Hey, so, you know, going from, maybe these are two polar opposites. You go from sequestration, which is a mechanical, you know, setting of a budget and cutting it and that sort of thing, and not very pro innovation, to this current focus on how do we bring innovation to the federal government, whether it's a procurement system or any other way. And so let's talk about that a little bit.
I guess you have to ask, you know, at the threshold, what do you mean by innovation? Do you mean innovating
processes? That was going to be my question for you.
Well, I'm asking you. What do you mean? Do you mean technology, bringing innovation, meaning bringing in the most current technology? Do you mean bringing innovation in terms of doing things a different way? You have to answer what do you mean by that term? And then whatever it is that you mean, how does it align with the fundamental mission of government? Because if you're doing something to do it and to not align it with the mission of government, especially in a budget challenge time, it could be problematic. You also have to ask, are we going to duplicate it? You know, to the extent that you can templatize, if you will, your processes so that they can be leveraged across the spectrum of government, that's probably good too, because you're trying to deal with less resources in the most efficient way. So, I don't know what that means, because, you know, the government doesn't produce a product necessarily. I mean, it produces reports and things and studies and does wonderful things, but it's not producing something for the commercial market necessarily. And so you have to ask, so our concept of innovation may not be easily translatable across the spectrum.
Right. Well, you could look at, okay, let's, you know, being a lawyer, innovation in processes. Really, mm-hmm. that's really reform. Right.
Yeah.
When you stop thinking, right?
Yeah.
And I think, to me, what the conversation I'm hearing, or what people are really talking about, is what they call innovation or not, is how do we reform the system to bring innovation, i.e., technology solutions, more rapidly, more cost effectively to the federal government. I mean, that's what I mean. Like, I've heard more than one government officials say, how do we get innovative companies to do, commercial companies to do business with the federal government?
Well, taking that a step further, how do we leverage innovation? How do we leverage new technologies that are out there, big data, you know, analytics? How do we take that and use it to the advantage of government to simplify the processes it confronts now, to make the day-to-day life of government easier? That's, I think, the question that you have to ask about innovation first and foremost. If we're innovating, if we're quote-unquote innovating just to duplicate a process, that's not necessarily helpful. But if we're innovating to bring in a process that makes it easier for the government to perform
across the process, you mean solution or technology, right?
Right.
So, you know, if you were king for the day, you know, and you wanted to, you know, quote, as I've mentioned, I've heard, you know, government folks say, how do I get innovative companies or, you know, the latest commercial technology, even if that makes sense, let's assume for a second that makes sense for whatever business operation the government's going to use it for. You know, what are some of the keys to accomplishing that?
Well, I think you've got to establish a collaborative environment for that to take place. You can't have an environment where it's adversarial or I hate saying oversight intense, because oversight is legitimate, especially when you're spending public funds. But
right, but there's always balance. There's balance in everything, Tom. Right. Right? I mean, that's the issue. Like you know, have we crossed into where the oversight is out of balance versus the operations?
Or is it duplicative? I mean, if your threshold cost of doing business just to get in to compete is so high because you have to have compliance mechanisms in place. You have to be prepared for these activities from different oversight entities. That may be a barrier, especially for small innovative companies to enter. And so you also don't want to do anything that competes with the private sector. I think understanding the lines where, this should be a function or an activity or a project should be performed in the private sector versus the public sector. This is kind of like the obverse of the old inherently governmental argument, right?
Sure.
What should the government be doing? I think you have to look at that. I think that to the extent that you have data requirements up front, and the constant tracking of those requirements, they can be a barrier. I mean, there are a number of people who've discussed this better than I can, the really high slope of cost that a firm has to undertake to participate in the market. And I think that would be something you'd want to tackle.
Right. And you know what? We have to tackle the last break, Tom. Okay. So when we come back, we'll be talking more to Tom Sisti. He is the Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Sisti. Tom is Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP. And Tom, this segment, I think I'm just going to do like the old-fashioned lightning round kind of thing and throw some terms at you and try to get your response to them. And I guess first and foremost, because we just did that with innovation in a certain sense, right? Like, what is it?
Okay.
and tease that out. But, first, I guess, contract duplication.
I feel like I'm being psychoanalyzed. We shouldn't have it. How's that? No, I mean, it's wasteful. If you have multiple procurements for the same thing across an agency or several agencies, the problem you have is, where's the game? Okay, I'm going to spend bid, prep, and proposal dollars to address each one of those, and I don't know where I'm supposed to put my capture team. I don't know where I'm supposed to put my program team, things like that. So you have that side of it, and on the government side of it, of course, it's like it's wasteful.
Right. Do you think it's increasing, decreasing?
I think it's kind of increasing.
Unfortunately, we hear that all the time that agencies are creating duplicative contract vehicles and bid and proposal costs on both the government and industry side that's a limited pool of money and could be used more effectively. That's another barrier to entry as well for small businesses in particular, because if you don't choose wisely which contract you get on, you spend your limited B&P and get on the wrong one.
Well, taken to the extreme,
you're done.
You have to compete for everything.
Yes, right, because you don't want to, for fear of being locked out of a particular agency marketplace. So, simplification.
Simplification?
Yes.
Well, we talked about this. We talked about taking down the structures and processes that are duplicative, right?
Mm-hmm.
That don't measure up from a benefit standpoint. You have to really do a cost-benefit analysis on each step you're taking to say, is this worth it? Is the risk I have here worth the expenditure?
Right. Do you see anybody in government right now
engaging in
that exercise?
I think that there are people engaging in that exercise. I think you see them on both sides of the aisle in both houses of Congress taking a quite a serious look at what needs to be done and really, actually, at some point, they've articulated, is the cost, worth what we're getting for this?
Right,
this
the process.
So, yeah. I mean, I the think you see it in the several acquisition reform initiatives that are underway.
Right. You see it on the executive side?
I think the executive side is taking a different approach to it and trying to think about how to innovate. I know that's the buzzword for the day, using different mechanisms for this. I don't know the outcome of it because it's too new.
Right. Better buying power.
Mm-hmm.
To a certain extent.
Well, that is a much more, that's in a class of itself. I mean, that is a very, very thoughtful program. I think there's a lot of energy going into that, just a lot of a skill going into that. That's a very powerful program.
Okay. Prices paid portal.
Prices paid for what? I mean, you're saying...
You're asking me?
Yeah, you're asking me. No, it's. I think the prices paid portal, I mean, there are a couple of assumptions that have to be laid out. Prices paid for what? What are the terms and conditions, time, you know, all of those issues that factor into contract pricing to assure that you have an accurate comparison.
Right. You know, it's kind of interesting as, you know, I'm going to try these out on you, see what you think. So prices paid portal, that's, you know, that's, I got a new acronym. It's LPR, low price regardless, right? Regardless of the terms and conditions, regardless of the quantities purchased. We just want the real low price period, no matter what the previous prices paid were based on in terms of terms and conditions and quantities, right? LPR, right? Yes. Or you could say LPRTC. That's too long, though, right? That's low price regardless of terms and conditions, right?
You know,
I mean, that's what the prices portal is driving,
right? I
didn't
know you were incorporating stand-up into your routine.
Well, just, you know, I've got to...
Tip your waitresses.
You know, we have LPTA. I figure you got to have another, you know, a new acronym as well. How about this one, prices paid portal, reverse auction by other means? Yeah, well, you know, it's the same concept, is that, I'm hearing about it every day. Companies are, their prices are being compared, not necessarily through the prices paid portal, but horizontal price comparison, where companies are being compared to, companies who are offering prices other places, and it's just, is that price lower or higher? Again, we're not considering other terms and conditions and that sort of thing.
I think that's the key. I think the key is, you know, it can work if it's done properly. I mean, you and I are old enough to remember the days when auctions were bad things because they motivated very bad behavior, they caused equitable price adjustments, and they stressed the industrial base that was providing goods and services to the government. Now we are at a point where we're willing to accept those for highly commoditized items.
Sure,
makes sense. So, yeah. I mean,
it's a tool in a toolbox, but the question is...
Right, exactly.
Right. And whether the prices paid portal is a, mm-hmm. you know, a spiral downward in pricing without a management of the information. And guidance to folks on how to actually analyze and use it in an appropriate way. Because, mm-hmm. you know, the government is a challenging customer to begin with, and this just has the potential to make it an even more challenging customer when you're ignoring, you know, actually the market, really. That's what you're talking about. You're ignoring the market to get to a particular price because mm-hmm. a market is defined by terms and conditions and outcomes that are driven by how much people actually promise to buy, how much they're guaranteed minimum, all that kind of thing. And you can't ignore the market. You can try, but in the long run, you're not going to...
You can't ignore the forces of the market. But at the same time, remember, you can't go all the way to the other extreme and not acknowledge that there are unique issues for the government. They are safeguarding the public fisc in a different way than a private sector corporation would be making expenditures. They are answerable to people on the Hill. So we have to balance. You know.
The role of GSA.
GSA certainly is a facilitator and can be a center of expertise in certain spheres. Certainly the schedules program, which, you know, many would argue is a shared services program, akin to a shared services or a sourcing program. It can be a mechanism for positive change.
Okay. Shared services.
I think with respect to shared services, we have to be careful that we're not setting up a sort of distorted competition with existing programs. I think a lot of times, in the same way, if you remember the Centers of Excellence and Lines of Business programs.
Yeah, Lines of Business. Yep, I remember those.
We had people who wanted to flash cut out of programs and go into those. Well, or take existing programs and turn them into
shared services or business
programs.
Lines.
Right. Those programs, that's problematic because I think, first of all, you've fundamentally changed the competition standard against which people submitted proposals. If people knew they were going government-wide, they might have bid differently. So you have a CECA issue in there, and first and foremost. And secondly is, how do you administer these across agencies? How do you get the commitments of orders that will justify bidding across agencies? It's one thing to say, yeah, you have the whole federal government, but if nobody orders from it, how do you compel, if you will, or commit agencies to these programs? I mean, you used to use an example. I forgot what it was. This office furniture? There was a contract you mentioned about a year ago, this contract, and there was a 1% commitment.
Oh, yeah. That's strategic sourcing, Tom. That's where, you know, in office supplies, they get commitment letters from the customer agencies, and they say, I conditionally commit if the contract meets my needs. So that's not a commitment in the first place. 1 or 2% of my annual spend. Well, if their annual spend on office supplies, or let's say it's janitorial supplies, is $150 million, so you're talking about $1 million a year. It's a conditional commitment of $1 million. That's why, you know, I think it'd be more focused to allow agencies to do their own strategic sourcing and not try to lump everybody into something that, you know, where you get to the lowest common denominator and it doesn't really meet anybody's needs. And with that, Tom, you know, it's time to go. So I want to thank my guest, Tom Sisti. He is Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP. And you have been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.